Susan Yawkey with VOA's Middle East Monitor podcast. Coming up, an appeal for reconciliation in Mali, a call for the United States to step up to the plate in Syria.
There is a growing mistrust of U.S. intentions, and I think consequences of that could be felt for a very long time.
Can Egypt's first democratically elected president keep his nation united? And a rights group says Arab Spring movements fell short. It's all ahead. A top French official says France's intervention in Mali has succeeded, but warns that Mali's warring factions must be reconciled for the country to be stable. Defense Minister Jean-Yves Le Drian says France is now working with Malian and African forces to restore the autonomy and territorial integrity of the Malian state, a process, he says, is going faster than many thought possible. But he said the situation of Mali is not secured yet. French-led forces were reported in control of three key towns in northern Mali Wednesday after al-Qaeda-linked militants fled their last stronghold and escaped into a vast desert region with their weapons. Correspondent Anne Look is currently embedded with French troops. VOA's Joe de Capua reached her by cell phone near the town of Ségou. That is in the central part of Mali, about 235 kilometers north of Bamako.
I'm coming along on a French military convoy. We're bringing food and gas up to French troops that are fighting in the north. We're headed all the way north to Gao, which was retaken last Saturday from the Islamists. These kind of logistical movements are key to keeping the forces active and the forces moving. This convoy, for example, I mean, we're more than 40 vehicles. We're almost 3 kilometers long. Yeah, we're just making our way slowly up to the north.
And can you tell us about reports that at least two Malian soldiers were killed today when their vehicle drove over a landmine?
We are getting reports that 2 and possibly as many as 4 Malian soldiers were killed outside of Gao last night as they were moving in a military convoy from the military base in Sévéré up to Gao. It appears that one car in a military convoy hit a landmine near Gossi, which is about 175 kilometers outside of Gao. So we don't have military confirmation on that, but a relative of a soldier in the convoy did tell VOA that it did happen. Keep in mind that the military haven't been confirming things like casualty figures and giving out information on that kind of thing. What's disturbing about that is that it does seem to confirm fears that the Islamists did mine roads or did leave kind of booby traps for troops coming in, you know, something that we've been hearing from residents of towns like Gao for a while.
And have you heard any more information about the government possibly negotiating with either the Tuaregs or the rebels?
Yeah, Mali's interim president, Jonkunda Traore, he spoke with RFI this morning. It was his first interview pretty much since this intervention began about 3 weeks ago. And when it came to the topic of negotiations, initially keep in mind that they were intending to negotiate with the Malian-led groups in the north, which would have been the Tuareg separatist group, the MNLA, and the Islamist group, Ansar Dine. Now, Jonkunda Traore is saying that they will not negotiate with Ansar Dine in light of the hostilities that have happened in the past few weeks. And he also kind of dismissed this idea that a segment of Ansar Dine has broken off and tried to say, no, they really want negotiations and all this. He dismissed that and said, nope, it's a bit too late for that. He did say that they would be willing to negotiate with the MNLA. Keep in mind, the MNLA are more of a secular rebel group, but he said they must give up their demands for independence in northern Mali for the state of Azawad that they declared last year. MNLA appear to still be around Kidal, which is kind of last major rebel stronghold in the north. The French took the airport in Kidal on late Tuesday, but we haven't really gotten any confirmation on whether or not they've gone to the town or what's really happening there. You know, communications are cut to Kidal. But there is a bit of concern just that the Malian troops aren't in Kidal yet and weren't along on that. The speculation is perhaps that there will be some negotiations happening with the MNLA and, you know, that perhaps this is what's going on with Kidal.
And have you had a chance to talk to any of the French troops to get their view on what's been going on in Mali?
No, for strategic and security reasons, they don't really give much detail. The French defense minister did say today that the mission was accomplished, that this taking of this airport in Kidal did mark kind of an end to a first phase. And what he said, you know, mission accomplished. He's been promising that French troops will not be deployed for a long period of time in Mali, et cetera. But he did say that it didn't seem like they'd be able to pull them out immediately, which has been a concern here in terms of as these three towns have been taken with actually no fighting in many cases, which has raised a lot of concerns that the rebels had already fled, that they are regrouping, that they've dispersed, and that, in all honesty, the first phase could be over, but the second and perhaps more likely much harder phase is yet to begin. That's something that Mali's interim president touched on this morning as well in his statements. It was a very internal conflict in Mali and various ethnic groups in northern Mali and tensions between northerners and the central government in Bamako. So there's a very local element, a very local dynamic, and that also needs to be dealt with.
VOA correspondent Ann Look in central Mali. The U.S. State Department welcomed the success of the French-led force in Mali and said its replacements will be challenged to hold newly liberated towns. Spokeswoman Victoria Nuland said the African force faces the task of pursuing the Islamists to ensure they cannot regroup and return. Extremists are well-armed, and they are known to have recruited child soldiers. Analysts say they also are likely to use civilians as human shields to defend themselves. French troops arrived in Mali nearly 3 weeks ago to push back Islamist forces heading for the capital, Bamako. While the 22-month-long civil war dragged on in Syria, foreign donors meeting in Kuwait pledged more than $1.5 billion to support United Nations relief operations for refugees over the next 6 months, exceeding the target amount sought. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon called it the largest response ever to a humanitarian pledging conference. Salman Sheikh is the director of the Brookings Institution's Doha Center. He spoke with VOA senior reporter David Arnold about the role of the international community in the worsening crisis, and David stopped by the studio earlier today to share what he said.
As a close observer of the work of the United States, France, and others who support efforts to overthrow President Bashar al-Assad, Salman Sheikh is in effect saying it's time for the United States to step up to the plate and show some creative leadership before it's too late. He quoted President Obama on the dire consequences of a failing Syrian state for the people of Syria, for the region, and for the world.
All the things I think that the president and the administration feared, which is the rise of extremism, the insecurity of chemical weapons, the dangers that it poses to Israel, a key ally, and other allies in the region, as well as sort of the regional spillover effects, all of these things are happening as a result, in my view, lack of leadership of the international community. And really, the United States is best placed to provide that leadership, both in terms of capability as well as exerting the political will that is required. On the arming efforts, what we've seen clearly, the evidence on the ground is that you cannot leave this just to regional forces. Even though there have been efforts most recently, as we're discussing, to try and organize the rebels on the ground, there has been a lack of capability to do so, as well as perhaps varying interests with regards to particular groups. The United States certainly can play a very great role in a train and assist mission of the rebels. Most of these rebel groups are on a sort of a subsistence allowance, which means that they still can be shaped. The problem is that a number of promises have been made to some of these groups, including perhaps even by U.S. operatives in the region, and they have not been fulfilled. So there is a growing mistrust of U.S. intentions, and I think consequences of that could be felt for a very long time.
David, what about other concerns?
President Obama has publicly expressed concern for the suffering of Syrian refugees, the risks for the region of chemical weapons being used by the Assad regime and by extremists on either side of the conflict. But Sheikh adds to the list the imminent threat to the lives of a greater number of Syrians, as many as 4.5 million Syrians inside the country, who are not getting the humanitarian aid they need.
Well, you know, as conditions get worse, the chances of greater intervention do become more likely. We saw that in the case of Bosnia, but unfortunately that took 4 years and 100,000 Bosnians killed and 50,000 women raped. I hope we don't have that same scenario, but we're approaching those kinds of figures in Syria now. As we see the threat of chemical weapons falling into either the wrong hands or being used by the regime, as well as a real, real humanitarian disaster inside the country, as well as across its borders. Let's not forget that there are perhaps over 2.5 million people who are now displaced from their homes inside the country. There's probably another 2 million in need of aid. That's probably 4 or 5 million out of a population of 23 million in total, that, which is only going to get worse. It will probably require intervention of some sort, and I think the longer we take, the more likely it is that it's going to be a much more complicated and fraught task.
My understanding of the humanitarian aid is that we're still very slow in responding, and one of the difficulties is to get into Syria to offer the aid, where you have pointed out the larger numbers of people are in need. The government there still controls much of the channeling of that aid, and therefore limits it and uses it as a tool. Isn't that correct?
That's correct. In fact, I would say humanitarian policy here, in terms of assisting the vulnerable civilian population inside Syria, is a mess. On the main international organizations, particularly the United Nations, is still adopting a state-based scenario whereby which it has to work through Syrian government agencies because of the questions of sovereignty or overriding government sovereignty. On the other side, we have a large number of countries who have now said that the government is in fact illegitimate and have recognized the Syrian National Council by not providing the kinds of resources that it needs in order to be able to particularly support those vulnerable populations in the north, in the east, in the south, and elsewhere in the country who are not going to get the government assistance. There needs to be much greater leadership than we've seen so far, where a greater U.S. role is required in the political, military, economic, and humanitarian aspects of the situation in Syria. If that is not forthcoming, I'm afraid we are likely to see Syria become the failed state that everyone has been warning about, with all the consequences for the entire region.
That was Salman Sheikh of the Brookings Doha Center discussing the role he says must be played by the international community in Syria.
VOA senior reporter David Arnold visiting us here earlier today in our Washington studios. The International Committee of the Red Cross has been using Damascus as a base to organize aid convoys to parts of Syria where the government allows it to operate. The ICRC funds aid programs in Syria and elsewhere using contributions from the European Commission, national governments, National Red Cross and Red Crescent societies, and private sources. VOA's Michael Lippin discussed the operation with Damascus-based ICRC spokeswoman Rima Kamal.
We do get assistance in terms of food, different items such as, for instance, blankets, mattresses, household items, and so forth, either shipped into the country or sometimes purchased locally through local manufacturers. So ICRC has a warehouse in Syria, and many items are stored in our warehouses and then distributed in accordance with the needs across the country and in cooperation with the Syrian Arab Red Crescent.
When you say shipped into Syria, are we talking about deliveries by road vehicles or by plane into Damascus Airport?
Right now, we're actually using the land borders and shipping things into Syria, transporting things into Syria, for the most part through the Jordanian borders.
I also want to ask you for your reaction to a press release that came out yesterday from Doctors Without Borders. The Médecins Sans Frontières issued a statement saying that it's concerned that the way your aid system is set up, with the aid efforts concentrated in Damascus and convoys going out from there to various parts of the country under cooperation and supervision of the government, they're concerned that that system is preventing a lot of aid from reaching areas where rebels are in charge and that many Syrians are missing out on the aid because of that system. Do you think that's a fair criticism?
We do acknowledge that there are big difficulties in accessing certain areas across Syria, such as Aleppo, Deir ez-Zor, and Al-Hasakeh and Idlib, which are areas in the northern part of the country that have also been heavily affected by the fighting. I think part of the reasons as to why it is also difficult to get to these areas is that the risks involved are very high. Right now, as you correctly said, we are based in Damascus, so any field trips we have to undertake have to also go from Damascus. So that's a lot of risks to take under the way. Like sometimes we do as well negotiate access to these places and try to channel assistance to these places, and we have succeeded, but we do acknowledge it's not enough and more needs to be done. When it comes to cross-border operations, I think that ICRC is ready to explore the possibility of carrying out cross-border operations in order to reach people in need. But I think, however, that these cross-border operations will not solve the problem of aid reaching certain areas, because you have a lot of victims that are concentrated in and around urban centers that are very difficult to reach from the border areas. So I think there has to be a number of mechanisms put into place. And I would say the foremost would be the respect of the beleaguered parties to aid convoys, and them allowing them to carry out their work and to reach people in need.
I'm curious to know if it's been a problem that aid that you're distributing within Syria is kind of misappropriated or diverted by rebels or pro-government fighters. Has that been a problem for you in the past?
We do face different challenges related to how aid reaches people in need. There has been several incidents of aid convoys being confiscated, some of the assistance taken off board and so forth. These are daily challenges that many humanitarian organizations deal with, unfortunately, on a weekly basis in Syria. It's not clear to us at all times who is, let's say, responsible. And what matters to us is that everyone respects the humanitarian organization that we are and try to facilitate for us as much as possible, and to as well remember that what we often bring into these areas is going to be channeled to people very much in need.
Damascus-based ICRC spokeswoman Rima Kamal. Egypt's government is facing violent street protests, calling into question the ability of the nation's first democratically elected president to keep his country united. VOA's Elizabeth Arrett reports from Cairo.
In Port Said and cities across Egypt, anti-government forces are calling for secession. President Mohamed Morsi imposed a state of emergency in some areas of unrest, while the army chief warned the state could collapse. These are chaotic days for Egypt, which recently marked 2 years since a revolution brought one system to an end. But the new one, a government dominated by Islamists, is being met with fierce resistance. Political analyst Mustafa al-Labad is among those who accused the Muslim Brotherhood, for decades underground, of being given a chance at democracy, then overreaching.
Muslim Brotherhood, after 84 years, is willing to take over not only the political system, but the whole Egyptian state. Their gear to exclude others and to take everything.
Amr Darag, a senior official with the Brotherhood's political wing, dismisses the idea.
Some are trying to make things look as if this is a confrontation between Muslim Brotherhood and the rest of the Egyptian people. It is not like that. It is not. And if it was, this would have meant that the rest of the Egyptian people are thugs and use violence, which is not the case.
Darag blames the unrest on a small number of violent criminals who are burning public property and scaring away foreign investors and tourists. Opposition leaders say discontent is much wider and point to the many peaceful protests of the past months. They argue a lack of economic improvement and social justice warrants a new national unity government, and have made that a precondition for talks. Political analyst Labad.
The president should commit himself to have a real dialogue with the opposition, not a dialogue where people are gathering with no specific agenda, with no commitment.
But government supporters argue the political transition is not complete. There's been a presidential election, but Egyptians must still choose a new parliament. Many are wary of that process, especially after Mr. Morsi helped push through a controversial new constitution. But publisher Rania Al-Malki, who took part in the revolution, believes the opposition needs a strategy beyond protests and boycotts.
You have to be part of that institution. Otherwise, you won't have a voice, and you're always going to have to depend on the popular anger of disaffected youth to further your own political agenda.
At this point, it appears some of Egypt's new insiders wouldn't mind sharing responsibility and what comes with it, blame. Again, Amr Darag from the Muslim Brotherhood's political wing.
Everybody has to have to share his part in the responsibility. I believe the president is trying to do his best. Of course, he made mistakes, you know, but definitely. I mean, he was never a president before, so he's also on the learning curve.
It's a rare admission of missteps, but a sign that after days of violence, perhaps some sort of reconciliation, however tentative, may be in the works. Elizabeth Arrett, VOA News, Cairo.
Representatives of International Watchdog Human Rights Watch say in their annual report that they are concerned about Syria, Mali, and other areas of so-called Arab Spring unrest. The New York-based group released their report today in London and in Johannesburg. Anita Powell has details.
Human Rights Watch says the euphoria and hope that spurred the Arab Spring movements 2 years ago have not brought about more rights for the people. The 665-page report released Thursday profiles human rights in more than 80 nations, including the United States. Syria's violence and repression dominated this year's report. The nation has been besieged by a rebellion that has left at least 60,000 people dead, according to United Nations estimates. Human Rights Watch's executive director Kenneth Roth, speaking on a live telecast from London, called on Russia and China to impose stricter sanctions on Syria in an attempt to further pressure the government of President Bashar al-Assad. But the watchdog group says both sides, the government and the opposition, have committed crimes against humanity and war crimes, such as torture and executions. Johannesburg-based spokeswoman Birgit Schwarz called for international measures.
Our major concern about Syria is really that there's not enough pressure put on the Syrian government and the Syrian rebels at this point to stem the atrocities. The best way, really, to ensure that there will be accountability at some point would be a referral of Syria to the International Criminal Court. This is not a biased move, because it would really mean that both sides, rebels as well as government forces, would eventually have to fear to be held accountable.
Roth is also critical of Egypt, saying the new Egyptian constitution is filled with loopholes that deprive citizens of their rights, and called for a strengthening of rights and free speech. The group also expressed concern that Islamist-dominated governments in Arab Spring nations may restrict women's rights. Tiseke Kasambala, advocacy director of the Africa Division, says Africa's rights landscape continues to worry them too.
The year 2012 witnessed some backsliding on democracy and improvement in human rights. The menace of terrorism in Nigeria, Somalia, and Kenya, as well as increased national and regional tensions. Countries that continue to make important economic developments and strides, such as Rwanda and Ethiopia, continued also to impose tight restrictions on freedom of expression and association.
Kasambala says Mali is of particular concern after a coup and a rebellion in 2012. French and Malian troops are currently trying to push back the rebels in northern Mali.
New or ongoing crises in Mali, Sudan, and South Sudan, continued war in the Democratic Republic of Congo, as well as long-standing repression in countries such as Ethiopia, as mentioned before, Eritrea, Sudan, and Zimbabwe, continue to undermine progress towards respect for human rights and the rule of law across the continent.
The group worries, too, about the potential for violence in elections scheduled for this year in Kenya and Zimbabwe. Anita Powell for VOA News, Johannesburg.
This has been VOA's Middle East Monitor podcast. Join us Monday through Friday for news from the region and of interest to the region. And for more Mideast coverage, visit our website at MiddleEastVoices.com. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Thanks for joining us.